What are you going to tell them?
All right. So, yeah, I've been asked to talk about the astrophysical interpretation of these apparently puzzling results on energetic positrons. And it's sort of scary because this means that my parable in the type of things I'm doing is clearly bringing me more towards astrophysics. I guess there's nothing wrong with that, but I've been devoting most of my time with the crazier interpretations. But anyway, so I will just go briefly over the data we'll talk about, and this has already been done in great detail by our previous speaker, Jonathan. I will then try to shortly summarize what's our standard understanding of E plus E minus in cosmic rays and primary electrons that we observe and measure. I will then discuss astrophysical sources of primary, both positrons and electrons, and essentially we'll only discuss one class because that's enough, and this class is pulsars inside supernova remnants. And then we try to put everything together. So these are the PAMELA data that have been eventually posted on the archive. And this is why so many theory papers have been put out. This is the supposedly theoretical background to the positron fraction, and these are the data. So there's clearly something going on there if we believe that this is really accurately the background, which I maintain is not the case. So the other interesting thing that PAMELA put out and that Jonathan also pointed out is the antiproton to proton ratio. This is indeed quite interesting to me from the point of view of new physics, in the sense that you actually get extremely tight constraints on any annihilation of a dark matter particle out of antiproton data, unless this particle does not produce any antiprotons whatsoever, which is the case if it has a purely leptonic pair annihilation mode. So in any event, this must be taken into account whenever one wants to discuss why this curve does not match the data. So the extra component has to be compatible with antiproton data. And notice that, you know, if you just recall the expression for the gyro radius of a particle in a magnetic field, you realize that these measurements are very tricky with a small payload like PAMELA, which is a thing that is literally extremely small, and it should measure curvatures which are instead very large for hundreds GeV. So this formula by itself tells us that there might very well be a significant contamination down there. But I'm a theorist, so I just believe that the experimentalists did their homework in the best possible way, and so we'll take this data as supposedly free of contaminations, such as the most obvious one, protons for mismatch for antiprotons. All right. So this is the other piece of information. This is the spectrum of the sum of electrons and positrons. And again, we saw that misidentified protons might very well contribute to this bump. But the bump is clearly there. It's been there in previous data taking by this ATIC experiment, and it's been confirmed and published in Nature, so it's got to be true. And this is a more recent publication by the Hess collaboration, where they, as we saw, measure the extragalactic gamma ray background in addition to electrons and positrons. These are atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes that measure electromagnetic showers and therefore are sensitive to both positrons, electrons, and gamma rays. And the Hess result is actually fairly interesting for the topic of this talk, because we will see that this puts some stringent constraints on what you would expect, and we saw some of these spectra in Jonathan's presentation, out of a nearby powerful pulsar. So this is, per se, a very interesting experimental result, which essentially has to be regarded mostly as an upper limit, because, again, we don't have a good understanding of extragalactic gamma rays. Keep in mind that there's many people that believe that EGRET did not actually detect with any statistical significance the extragalactic gamma ray background. So this is another element of possible contamination here. So we regard this essentially as an upper limit. So the interesting thing, if you look back at the literature, is that it looks like there is nothing new under the sun. As a matter of fact, in 1995, Atoyan, Aronian, and Folk, who are three experts in the field of theoretical studies of cosmic rays, put the following quote: "The measured content of positrons in the total electron flux," and they're referring to data in 1990, "is regarded as a possible enigma awaiting an explanation. It is obvious that some source of positrons is needed." And they were looking at this data, which, as we know, are from the Molson chamber. And, of course, now we have much better data, but the problem the enigma was already there, 20 years ago, almost, when I was in elementary school. So there is, in addition to the much improved quality of data on positrons and electrons, an extra ingredient today, which is the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. And there is an entire group of people in the Fermi collaboration, mostly led by Alex Moisev, who's a scientist at NASA Goddard I'm working with, that is, trying to understand how to measure electrons and positrons with the Large Area Telescope, which is the main instrument on board Fermi. And this is a chunk of a slide of the presentation Alex gave at the Next to Last collaboration meeting. And he says that they're working to detect electrons above 20 GeV. The reason why they cannot detect or they don't keep track of electrons below 20 GeV is that, as we saw, the spectrum is very steep and there's just too many events below 20 GeV. They're actually working, trying to push this threshold a little bit closer to 10 GeV or so. But 10 GeV is basically where the trigger is, so you cannot really go below that. And the LAT is able to detect electrons and positrons and have a decent energy resolution all the way up to 1 TeV, so this is fairly interesting. But the most interesting thing is that the LAT has a geometric factor, or an effective area, of roughly 1 meter squared per steradian. And this is huge, because we saw that ATIC has an effective area of 0.24, but ATIC is not constantly there in the sky taking data. It takes data for a few days, and that's about it. GLAST is there, is taking data, is working well, and it has a factor of 4 or 5 larger effective area. And it's much, much larger than the one of PAMELA. So in 1/50th of the time, GLAST collects as many electrons and positrons as PAMELA does. So this is going to be very interesting, and here is the electron energy range where the LAT will collect an enormous amount of data. In particular, Alex estimates that the LAT will detect roughly 10 million electrons above 20 GeV per year and more than 2,500 above 500 GeV, so in the very interesting range where there is this, what Alex calls, promising feature detected by ATIC. These are, of course, the old data. But the feature is still there. So, LAT is going to have a lot to say in this business. It's a complicated analysis, but the team is working, and they're working both in this direction and in this direction to try to optimize the understanding of the detector and the energy range that could be reliably used. So, off to cosmic rays and the production of electrons and positrons. So, the standard lore is that positrons essentially are all secondary particles that derive from the collision of primary protons and to a smaller extent other nuclei with the nuclei in the interstellar medium. So, this is a fairly old industry in the sense that starting in 1976, people have been putting out codes more and more complicated and more accurate in the treatment of, for instance, nuclear reactions and the nuclear chains that lead to the production of a whole host of different secondary cosmic rays, which are then detected locally by various experiments. And the idea is, it's a self-consistent approach in the sense that, you choose some, in fact, arbitrary incident energy distribution for your primaries, and then you walk your way through all of this chain of reactions that give rise to secondary to primary ratios, give rise to gamma rays, X-rays, synchrotron emission in radio, and as well as, directly positrons and electrons that you can actually measure in conjunction with a whole lot of other things. So it turns out, for instance, that gamma rays give a tremendously tight constraint on this game. So, you have some freedom initially to do this, but if you want to reproduce self-consistently the whole story, then the freedom you have is actually fairly limited. Of course, there is several caveats. For instance, cosmic rays are measured locally, while what enters in this game has to do, and this is a slide from Igor Moskalenko, one of the authors of Galprop, throughout the galaxy. So, of course, we take our data here, but it's the entire galaxy that, for instance, produces gamma rays of synchrotron emission and so on. But the idea to keep in mind is that all of this is a self-consistent game, which means that you have to explain at the same time with some primary source that injects not only electromagnetic stuff but also nuclei. You have to follow the propagation, the energy losses of these things, their secondary products, and so on and so forth. And in the end, you get hopefully a self-consistent picture. So as far as electrons and positrons are concerned, the main piece of theory that we need to keep in mind is that they lose energy very effectively when they are energetic. And in particular, they lose energy in two ways, via synchrotron emission, because the charged particles propagating inside magnetic fields in the galaxy, and through inverse Compton, which is nothing else than the collision of an energetic electron or positron of some photon in the radiation background of the galaxy, which includes sort of at the same level starlight and the cosmic microwave background. So here I come to the lifetime of positrons as a function of energy, and this clearly tells us that if you think of a burst-like injection of positrons, then this burst-like injection, if we detect stuff at 1 TeV, cannot be older than roughly 10 to the 5 years. So this is the maximal time scale. Once you put this together with a diffusion coefficient, you realize that effectively positrons are also cut off in space, and the cutoff is roughly around the kiloparsec, which applies, of course, to dark matter as well, meaning that if we detect a TeV electron or positron out of dark matter annihilation, that annihilation can only have occurred within a kiloparsec or so.
Well, when we go to lower energies, then we're seeing larger bodies.
Yeah, but absolutely, that's correct. But of course, here we are mostly interested in the range, say, between 20 GeV and 1 TeV. So, you can do the math, but essentially that's the volume we are really interested in, in both time and space. So here's the simple expression that is a good approximation to the propagation in space and time of a burst-like injection of a power law distribution of electrons or positrons. So this is the source of electrons and positrons, which has a certain slope to it, alpha. And this is the flux of positrons or electrons as a function of distance and time from the source. So there's a few things. There is a cutoff, which is dictated by the fact that we have energy losses, which is what Jonathan was telling us about. And these energy losses account for both synchrotron and inverse Compton losses. So there is a sharp cutoff there. And there is this type of exponential decay with a characteristic scale that is dictated by the diffusion coefficient, which, again, depends on the self-consistent model of cosmic rays, which we derive out of a whole lot of measurements. So we have essentially two things here. We have a time scale, which is when the injection occurred, and we have an effective diffusion radius that tells us how many electrons and positrons actually reach us from the source.
Gamma? What is gamma?
Oh, gamma is simply the energy over the mass of the electron. I'm sorry, yeah, it's the Lorentz factor, yes. So to give you an idea of what these spectra look like, the usual thing is to plot E to the third power times the flux. And here you see the spectrum of a burst-like injection of electrons and positrons with a power law of 2.2, which is roughly what we are talking about to explain cosmic rays. if you know your diffusion coefficient goes like the energy to the 0.6 or 0.7. This source is located 0.1 kiloparsec away, and here you see what happens if you consider different times for the injection. So when the source is young, the cutoff is at higher energy, of course, and most of the electrons and positrons are concentrated in this high energy part of the spectrum. You increase the time, you go to curve number 2, 3, 4, and 5, and increase from 2.5 times 10 to the 4 to 4 times 10 to the 5, and you see that you, at a given injected power, you not only decrease, obviously, the flux of electrons and positrons, but you also change the shape of the spectrum, both the location of the cutoff and the slope. So plausibly, you know, the sources we are talking about are not burst-like, but we know that most of the energy that the supernova releases is released at the explosion, so we expect some kind of effect, in the time profile of the emission of electrons and positrons, and this brings about corrections to the spectrum that sort of look like this, and all of these plots are taken from this 1995 Atoyan et al. Paper. So you essentially have an extra tail if you don't have a burst-like injection, but you have some type of continuum injection after the burst. What could these sources of bursts of electrons and positrons? Well, the standard law is that cosmic rays are mostly sourced by supernova shock acceleration, and E plus E minus inside the supernova are produced by pulsars, so by neutron stars at the core of the supernova remnant. And the physics there is fairly simple, although probably not entirely understood. And I'm not an expert on this, but roughly speaking, what happens is that the electric fields in the magnetosphere are sufficiently large to pair produce electrons and positrons in cascade. And then if you live here in the polar cap regions, then these electrons and positrons can actually escape in sort of like a two-jet type structure. So we have a source of electrons and positrons that we know is there. There's naturally more than one. And we actually have fairly good reasons to believe that most of the cosmic rays are produced in these objects. So we already saw this list. This is a collection, a fairly partial list of nearby supernova remnants, which are also hosting a pulsar in their center. So there's a collection of distances and ages. This is a plot where this particular collection of supernova remnants are put in a diagram where there is the age of the burst versus the distance. And these isolevel curves correspond to constant fluxes of electrons and positrons. So the fluxes decrease going in this direction. So clearly, the three brightest objects are Vela, Monogem, and the Cygnus Loop, at least in this fairly partial collection of nearby supernova remnants. So it makes sense, as Kobayashi told did in 2004, to ask the question of what the spectrum of electrons and positrons injected by these pulsars looks like in this diagram, electron versus electron energy versus flux. Yes.
Can you go back? I'm sorry, but this is probably a really stupid question, but I don't understand what is the age versus distance? What is that? The distance is the distance to the source. The age is how long it's been on.
So the idea is that these pulsars. Emit electrons and positrons in a burst-like fashion, where most of the electrons and positrons are emitted at the explosion of the supernova. So there is a certain point in time where most of the electrons and positrons are emitted.
They can still come later. The point is, they can still come.
Yeah, they can still emit something.
Those are the ones that are diffused further.
Exactly.
That's why I see. Sorry. I think I understand.
So
how are electrons and how are positrons produced in the supernova?
Well, so in the pulsar, you produce.
Oh, the pulsar, not the supernova.
Right, and then the role of the supernova shock is essentially to accelerate these objects.
Okay, but the positrons are actually produced very close to the pulsar.
As far as I can understand, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's no way to produce. Well, I guess in very intense shocks you can. But probably they cannot go to such high Lorentz factors. So probably the pulsar sources the positrons, and the shock accelerates both electrons and positrons. That's
so now, you know, years after the supernova, there's still a source of positrons and electrons, but they're just going to be piled up at low energies.
Exactly. That get to us. As far as I understand, that's not the case. So the secondary production of electrons and positrons out of hadronic collisions of primary protons at the site of the supernova remnant is actually a secondary. It's actually a secondary mechanism, as opposed to these primary protons propagating in the galaxy and hitting the gas there. So that's at least my understanding. Yes.
What's the time scale of these protons?
It's much less than these timescales. I'm not an expert on these, but Mark, maybe you have an idea of what's the timescale.
I was under the impression that a pulsar continued to produce electron positron pairs.
Oh, absolutely, so, yeah. So in fact,
I mean, well after the supernova goes off.
But this is the this is what you get out of the idea is that the pulsar continuously emits positrons,
yeah.
and in doing this, it slows down. So its rotational speed goes down, and it loses energy by emission of relativistic particles. So you probably realistically have something like this, and this depends on the rate at which the pulsar loses energy by emission of relativistic particles. So certainly, most of the injection comes from the burst, but then there is for sure some extra component there.
You were saying that they can't look a lot like one, or the curve one there, I guess, is modeling some pulsar which is still pretty bright even after the
exactly
supernova.
So yeah. So if you look here at the luminosity of the pulsar as a function of time in this particular study, this is what they use, and this ratio of tau star over t is 0.1 in this particular case one. So it's
So you're going to consider things that look more like two or three, where there's.
It doesn't really matter in the sense that most of what we care will come from the bump, from the main burst. So it's a second order correction. And in addition, you have some cutoff energy in the spectrum itself, because naturally you cannot go to arbitrarily high energies. But I'm going to neglect that as well, because again, it's irrelevant. It just affects slightly the spectral shape there.
This may be a stupid question. that list of pulsars or supernova remnants you
yes.
have, are these just ones with their jets aligned so that they point towards us? Or does that not matter?
No. These are not AGM. These are not lasers. These are objects that are detected in a multi wavelength in several multi wavelength observations. All of them emit radio. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, this is the type of spectrum you predict, and
sorry.
Yeah.
And the normalization of these?
Very good question. So essentially, you have out of radio measurements a pretty good handle on the amount of energy that the pulsar, that the supernova remnant gives off, and this is pretty much the main driver of the normalization of these objects. And this is in the ballpark of 10 to the 48, 10 to the 49. ergs total. And you have another parameter, which is the efficiency at which this energy is released in the form of electrons and positrons. And this is widely believed to be of the order of a percent. So you have roughly 10 to the 47. But this 10 to the 47 and 10 to the 49 can actually be quantified fairly well in terms of the radio emission of the pulsar and the period of the pulsar. So there's a fairly accurate idea of where the normalization is for a given pulsar.
But the fact that Vela, for example, is way above what Hess saw, what does that mean? Does that mean we don't understand how much energy is being lost? Or does it we messed up something with Vela.
Right, exactly. So I don't remember what they use here in terms of the normalization to Vela. I think this analysis is does not actually use pulsar data to reconstruct the normalization. So my understanding is that and in their paper as well, they go up and down quite a bit in the normalization, just because they just set it arbitrarily to a 10 to the 49 ergs, where it might very well be less than that. I mean, it actually is less than that, otherwise we would have seen this bump,
right.
And Hess does not. So
the theoretical predictions are not robust.
Well, no, I'm just saying that in this particular paper here, they sort of set one number for the total power emitted in positrons and electrons. Well, what I'm claiming is that that number could be more precisely quantified modulo this energy transfer to electrons and positrons once you know the period of the pulsar and you know the radio emission of the pulsar.
Typically, there would also be like a gas envelope or something around after the supernova. Would you not see gamma rays if you had such a high density of positrons? You know,
absolutely, and in fact, you do.
So I mean, have people tried to cross-correlate the number of gamma rays, the flux with?
This is an excellent question, and I have the next to last slide that exactly addresses that. So these are the results of an analysis that came out after the Pamela data were taken pictures of by Hooper, Blasi, and Serpico. And here, essentially, they show that contribution from pulsars over the entire galaxy provide a very good fit to the Pamela data. Here, in particular, they consider supernovae across the entire galaxy, and they vary, for instance, the rate of supernova per year. And you see that it's perfectly reasonable to have roughly one supernova every 30 years, which is this line. And here they see what happens if you remove entirely or if you double the number of local supernovae within a radius of 500 parsecs. So again, this is per se a plausible explanation to the Pamela data. They also go ahead and look at two particular nearby pulsars, Geminga and Monogem. And again, they show that with some massaging of the injection slope of electrons in these objects and seemingly pointing to a fairly steep spectrum for these two objects, again, you can easily reconcile the Pamela data with a supernova remnant / pulsar interpretation. Here they put everything together, so this is the contribution from all supernova remnants, and then there is the breakup of the two local supernovae that they consider. So you have a fairly decent, almost perfect, reproduction of the positron fraction as seen by Pamela. This is done by requiring that the energy transfers in the pulsar 2e plus any minus, as I said, at the level of 1%, which is what theory sort of points to. And they also point out that the possible handle over a dark matter scenario, in the case in which you don't have a nearby clump of dark matter, is to study the anisotropy of the arrival directions of electrons and positrons, the idea being that these guys are local, and so to some extent they have directional information because they are energetic and they come from relatively close distances. Of course, this would depend critically on how well the GLAS folks will do in reconstructing data for E plus and E minus.
So why do I care about all the pulsars in the Milky Way, given that you told us already that you only see stuff within a couple parsecs? Didn't you just
well,
give us the...
because, it's true that you mostly... That you will mostly get stuff out of the close-by pulsars, but, the galaxy is very big. And so...
But the propagation...
Absolutely. So particularly in the low energy end of the spectrum. In fact, you see that here most of the stuff is in the low energy. You get a coherent superposition of supernovae. So that's something you have, which they claim is probably subdominant with respect to these two local nearby sources. But still, it's there, and particularly at low energy matters. Okay, this is another study, again, on Geminga by Yüksel, Kissel, and Stanev, which was motivated by the fact that there were actually gamma ray observations of Geminga. And, I don't have here the one data point they have, but essentially what they do is they assume that the gamma rays were produced by these energetic electrons and positron inverse Compton scattering off actually the CMB, near the Geminga pulsar. And by normalizing that, they make these predictions where you have some leeway because you don't have a handle out of a single point on the spectral shape of the gamma ray emission, so you don't have a handle on the spectral shape of the primary electrons either. But the bottom line here is that, again, you can feed the positron fraction out of a self-consistent treatment of the Geminga pulsar. However, as you see here, When you look at the attic data, it looks like the Gamma pulsar is absolutely not enough to provide any sort of meaningful contribution there. All right, so you know, my idea is essentially to yeah. It's a positron fraction, yeah.
And that can explain Pamela.
Well, these are the Pamela data, so. Yeah. So I mean, don't look at this part of the spectrum.
But
sort of,
you get enough positrons to explain Pamela.
Yeah, if you normalize it with the gamma ray data.
If you normalize it with the gamma ray data. But then the next slide you said, but you can't explain Pamela.
That's correct.
What?
Mm-hmm.
How is that one?
Well, these are the curves you have for the spectrum of, you know, attic is in a completely different energy range, so there's, I guess, nothing surprising, no? I mean,
well,
you simply don't have enough electrons and positrons to explain these axes, you know.
So those axes are
about...
Yeah, yeah. The attic bump is here around, you know, 600-700 GeV, while the Pamela data extend to 100 or so.
So that extrapolation is okay. Extrapolating those models up to
This is not an extrapolation. This is an absolute prediction of what the plus or minus flux out of Gamma is. So it's actually even normalized in this case because of the gamma ray data. So that's a pretty robust demonstration that Pamela can be easily fitted with.
Which
an existing
data is?
A Milagro. It's a Milagro point at, I think, 20 TeV or so. Yeah, I don't know how the measurement looks like, but it's a 20 TeV. So.
No,
I don't know if it's one. It's one data point, not one photon.
It's one bin. It's probably
yeah.
Got some finite width.
Some finite energy. I mean, it's
but you're right,
it's one
very few
cross.
Gamma-rays.
Yeah, actually, I probably have the paper here. So let's. I can show you the actual paper. I think it's this one. Ah, here is the Milagro point. So, you know, this is the reconstructed gamma ray spectrum, and they normalize it in such a way that. Well, you know, if you, as I said, you don't have a handle on the slope, which is why they have three curves. But it's, you know, it's legitimate to normalize whatever slope you have to the one data point they have.
Do you understand why they only have data in one bin if they have more than one photon? I mean, were they only looking at a very narrow energy range?
You know, I don't really know the Milagro result there, but yeah.
That's a bunch of it's a swimming pool, right?
Yeah. All right. So essentially, the question I've asked myself is.
Can you go back one more time.
Oh yeah.
So these shaded. Are we supposed to add the pulsar to the primaries and secondaries and stack them on top?
Yeah, that's right.
But it's still not enough. So we're starting at the gray line, the gray shaded thing.
Yeah, I think that it would be somewhere like there or so.
Okay, fine.
All right, so, you know, the question I asked is the following. Can we work our way back from the data to the supernovae? So essentially, the parameter space is fairly nice for someone who worked for some amount of time on supersymmetry and you know, the 110 parameters of the MSSM. You only have essentially the emitted power, and you have some idea of what this is, distance, age, and the spectral index. So you know, once you fix, for instance, out of the Pamela data, your diffusion setup, then you can actually ask the question where in this parameter space do I get the best fit to data? And that's what I'm doing here. So this is, again, the plane of age versus distance. I'm fixing the power law to a plausible value of 2.2. And I'm fitting the Pamela data. And here are curves of constant chi squared for the Pamela data. So the Pamela data favor this band here of distance and age. The overall fit to all of the available E plus E minus data is this black curve here. And if you only want to fit the attic data, then you want something that is pretty much there. So I'm singling out this point model A, which will not give a good fit to Pamela, but will certainly give a good fit to the attic bump. And as you see, there's a bunch of supernova which are known to exist somewhere overlapping with the favored parameter space, and this comes not as a surprise because we just saw that Geminga or this pulsar can give good fits to Pamela. So here I do the same thing, but this time, in this case I'm normalizing to the E plus E minus data, while here I'm normalizing to the Pamela data. And I should also add that on the right panel here, I'm showing the normalization in units of 10 to the 48 in terms of the emitted power. So roughly W equals to 1 is what you expect for a standard, for the standard emitted power of a supernova remnant. So we are in a reasonable ballpark. Again, same thing for the Pamela data. And you have, again, some parameter space where you supposedly can fit fairly well the plus E minus and the positron fraction data. And then you look at the orthogonal slices of the parameter space. So here I'm fixing the distance at 300 parsec, and I'm doing chi-square contours in the age versus slope parameter space. And you see that here Pamela sort of wants a fairly hard spectrum, while the plus E minus data point towards a softer spectrum for the primary shape of the plus E minus. And notice that this is pretty much where we expect the true primary slope to be, so around 2.2 or so. Same thing this time fitting to the Pamela data. And here are the results for the four models that I pointed out overlap with the Pamela data. So there's absolutely a fairly good match with the data, with the exception of this model A, which was designed to reproduce the attic bump. So in fact, you see here that all of the models are sort of vaguely in the correct ballpark to reproduce the Hess data and the attic data, with the exception of this bump, which might or might not be statistically significant.
Sure I'm understanding at least the big picture. So those two different fits are however incompatible, because you're also varying some galaxy propagation parameters.
No, I'm fixing the propagation parameters, and then, for instance, here I'm normalizing my given supernova remnant to have the best possible fit to the Pamela data.
So you can just have one source be one and the other be the other and get them both. Right?
That's correct. Yes, and in fact, that's what I'm doing here. So I'm taking into account the three closest supernova remnant. And I'm hypothesizing this supernova remnant X, which would explain the attic data. And in this way, I have a nice fit with my existing supernova to the Pamela data, and a decent fit to the attic bump as well, out of only two sources. So now the question is there anything that sort of looks like the supernova remnant X? And to address this question, one opens up this web page, which gives a complete catalog of all pulsars with ages, distances, and emitted power. And it turns out that there is a reasonable candidate, which is this pulsar here, that is roughly located where the attic best fit point is here, suppose. So it's roughly here, with an age of 3, 4 times 10 to the 5, and a distance of 700 parsecs or so. And it's perfectly reasonable that this supernova remnant supposedly responsible for the attic bump was not detected so far, but there is in fact a candidate which is plausible, and this candidate is again this supernova remnant here, and once again the normalization is sort of reasonable with the ballpark of the expected emitted power. So just to give you an idea of
what's the magnetic field of that pulsar, I'm surprised you haven't said anything about it. So
yeah.
The upper cutoff is fixed by the magnetic field.
Yeah, but not in the pulsar. It's the galactic magnetic field that intervenes between the pulsar and us that drives the synchrotron losses. So,
so the upper cutoff in energy comes from the distance of the intrinsic flux.
Yeah, you remember that for different bursts and also for different distances, you just move the cutoff to lower and lower energies.
So for someone not in this gig, what are the constraints on opening up this catalog of pulsars, finding pulsars, and putting bumps all over these spectra?
Oh, there are no constraints, yeah.
There are no constraints.
In the sense that, you know, you have a catalog and the right thing to do would be to, you know, make sure that our cosmic ray data are compatible with what we believe is the source of cosmic rays. And in particular, you know, it just takes a couple of relatively bright supernova remnants to explain perfectly well the positron data of supernova remnants that, you know, do not live in fantasy but actually are in a catalog. So.
What was the spectral slope of the flux for these?
Yeah, so you might notice that...
in the injector. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for all of these three objects here, I assume 2.2, which is sort of the standard expectation. And I believe for these supernova remnant texts here, I also assume 2.2. While for this particular candidate here, I'm assuming a harder spectrum. So I'm massaging the primary injection spectrum to 2.1, I think, 2.05 or so. And in fact, you see that this is, you know, significantly steeper.
Right.
So where do the... Let's go back to Marcus's question. Sorry.
Yep.
We're postulating that all of the positrons come from supernova remnants. Or we're trying to find one nearby supernova remnant that's going to give us that bump, right?
Well, that's the minimal thing you can
do. Now, to get the highest energy, we think that to be really close. Right? So that SMRX can produce that bump there. But what's producing the positrons at higher energy?
Well, you know, it can be a superposition of various things like this. You know, supernova at various distance, and that's fairly reasonable. So the thing is that the attic cutoff...
But the highest energy ones have to be very close.
Closer, yeah. In fact, the supernova remnant is roughly 700 parsec. So it's more distant than these other ones. But it's a little younger and is a little more powerful.
Okay. So what
determines the power
again? Well, as far as I understand, you can reconstruct the total emitted power out of measurements of the period of the pulsar. Because, you know, you essentially assume that all of the energy is rotational. And so you work your way back when you have information on the age and on the pulsation and the radio emission. That's at least my understanding.
Okay.
So, I mean, is it the message I'm kind of getting from this is that, you know, there are a lot of pulsars which are, I mean, is this right that there are a lot of pulsars out there, they're emitting positrons. Their standard understanding of pulsars is correct. They're emitting positrons exactly in the regions where these experiments are doing things, and we shouldn't be surprised if we see bumps sticking up. We can just flip over
probably
the catalog and find some pulsar
exactly.
Without massaging astrophysics or anything.
Absolutely.
That's
without message. You know, and you for a pulsar at 700 parsec, it's perfectly plausible that it's an object we haven't detected yet in X-rays or radio. Or optical
and
you know,
yet
surveys.
You're saying this one exists.
And yet this one
in
particular exists. I mean, not the supernova remnant X, which gives the the perfect thing, but there is one.
A similar one.
There is one that you know gives a reasonable bump that sort of looks like that. So you know, it's there's really nothing that you're asking of reality. I think.
And the reason why other pulsars are not contributing, like Vela or some of the other ones. Why are they?
Yeah, so you sort of can see these from these lines. No? Here you have a very bright nearby source, this BO656, which is the monogem supernova remnant, and it does contribute up here, but still, you know, it does not give off a sharp cutoff. Maybe because it has a softer primary injection spectrum. Maybe because the combination of age and distance are such that you don't have as sharp a cutoff as you expect in other cases.
I think what I'm asking is we know within our nearby area there's 10 of them. Why don't you have 10 curves on here? What is the explanation for
it's
the
just
other
that
ones are
it's
not
just
as
that
much power?
Yeah, it's just that I did this plot a couple of days ago and I didn't have time to pull all the pulsars. So.
Wait, but is there a reason to understand why? You're saying that we understand why their power is less and why these are the ones that will dominate?
Yeah, you remember that plot with the isolevel contours to the electron-positron flux, right?
Let's go back to that.
Yeah, sorry.
let's see. This sort of this sort of gives you an idea of what contributes most. Now, here you go down in contribution to the electron-positron flux, one order of magnitude, passing from this curve to this, to this, to this.
But it's the brightest one.
Well, they are the brightest ones if you fix the emitted power, but each pulsar, I mean, it's not guaranteed that every pulsar emits the same amount of energy.
So that's what you're floating. You're saying Vela or Cygnus loop, you just drop their power in your fit.
They probably, you know, came off a pulsar which was rotating more slowly or from a smaller star.
Okay.
There's a lot of variety in the size of astronomical objects. I think that's, you know, pulsars have a certain spread of energy.
But we know the data about the rotation of Vela.
Yeah.
So can't
yeah, the missing thing there is, again, the efficiency with which you transfer the total amount of energy, which you can reliably estimate, into electrons and positrons. So this probably also depends on the morphology of the magnetic fields and all sorts of things. So I don't think there is one number either.
So is this sort of game of sculpting positron spectra with pulsars ever going to get more constrained in the near future? Are there more constraints on this from upcoming anything?
Yeah, and this leads me to this slide here. So the intriguing thing is that Fermi, the thing that Fermi is doing the best so far in its early lifetime, is discovering pulsars. Is exactly discovering gamma ray pulsars. They're discovering almost one pulsar a day out of blind searches. Even in Santa Cruz, there is a team that is just analyzing data in real time and looking for periodic signals in the entire gamma ray sky, and they're finding one pulsar a week doing that. So one handle we have is in the gamma ray regime with GLAST. This is an example of the multi-wavelength spectrum of a pulsar, and out of this spectrum, putting together ACT data, X-ray data, and radio data, essentially we are in the position of pretty much constraining a lot of the features of the primary electron-positron distribution out of pulsars. So, there's some leeway because, again, most of the electron-positron come from the first burst, but yet we're going to have a lot of information out of GLAST on this particular topic. So, and these are my conclusions, and I'm sorry if I took a little longer than what I was supposed to. So, I think that this is really a case for Occam's razor. Do we need anything else to explain the positron data? And I'm convincing myself that that's not the case. That's really not the case. I mean, there are these sources. These sources are widely believed to be the source, the primary source of galactic cosmic rays, and they are known to produce, to some extent, electron-positron pairs. And, if you look at the spectra and you look at the pulsars which are out there, you find reasonable matches. In addition, again, Fermi is discovering a lot of nearby gamma-ray pulsars, so we're going to have a lot of data, and it will make sense to, again, work our way back with multi-wavelength campaigns out of the Fermi data. And in addition, we'll also have fantastic statistics out of Fermi on exactly the E plus E minus spectrum, so, we'll have a better understanding, for instance, of whether or not this attic bump is there. And I guess this is all I want to talk about. Yes?
It looks like we can't set down yet, so
I just wanted to see the Pamela fit again.
All right, there was a bunch, but let's see. One of them is, for instance, this one.
Yeah.
And this is, again, just with these two supernova remnants.
Right.
So if you sum all four, you get this purple line here.
Okay, and how does the normalization of this, is that related to the Milagro?
No.
Not at all. Is there a way to...
Oh, you mean for Geminga? No, for Geminga, I just essentially put in a reasonable number for the normalization. Yeah.
I see. I'm just wondering if there's any way to get a cross-check on this, because that would be sort of...
Yeah, I think gamma rays are actually a powerful cross-check.
I wanted to ask about that, because I don't know, maybe it's because I'm old and slow, but I don't feel like I really understand, I've understood from what's been talked about, this their connection there between the glass, you know, Fermi type observations and this. So how what is the connection there, and how is that gonna constrain things?
Well, for instance, you know, we saw Mark was very disappointed with the Milagro single data point, and rightly so. What Glass will do is it will put a lot of data points there, which will tell us about the spectrum, which will tell us the normalization.
So the connection is just you know, really basic question. So just these pulsars just also produce a lot of these gamma rays that are
exactly
observed
so
in these photon experiments. That's the point.
Correct.
So
the accelerating region has to have a magnetic field. And it also has to have some fixed size.
The pulsar.
The region around the
pulsar wind nebula or whatever it's called.
So, you know, some of the sources have very high magnetic fields. And if you're accelerating positrons to very high energy, they're going to run into magnetic field and produce synchrotron photons.
Which is this bump here.
So there should
be.
If you postulate a source of a given size and a given magnetic field, you know what the positron production rate is.
The only modeling number is that you, of course, you're seeing the photons that are being emitted much more recently, right?
Correct.
So you've got to believe you know something about the long time tail of what these pulsars do.
Yeah, but the cool thing is that Glass is observing very nearby and fairly recent supernovae. So, you know,
so
you have
a little bit more quantitatively, is it possible for Glass to put a damper on your Occam's razor and start making it tough for pulsars? I mean, are they in a range where they can, if you put it all together, they could actually make it hard for pulsars to...
So in some cases, yes. In some other cases, no. For instance, I did the exercise of taking the supernova remnant X and calculating the inverse Compton emission. And it turns out that their Glass will probably barely detect it. So there's not but
yeah but
there you also have some leeway with the cutoff of the highest energy electrons, because your production mechanism of gamma rays is through inverse Compton, so you're very sensitive to the high energy end of the spectrum, which is fairly relevant here.
What about Hess-Miller, the highest
energy? It will actually do fairly well because you expect something like this for generic inverse Compton emission, and you know you can see here that, for instance, Kangaroo is doing much better than Egret, but you know Glast will do a factor 20 to 50 better than Egret, so would be also complementary information. Yes.
You have two free parameters for pulsar: the slope of the injection and the overall normalization.
The age and the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, those are fixed by observation.
That's correct.
Right, but then these other two are those just things that you're picking
with that. So the source injection spectrum sort of has to be self-consistent with your propagation model. So that is between 2 and 2.3, roughly. And then the normalization, again, is related to
but
the emitted power.
You're changing it within that range per pulsar, right?
Mm-hmm.
You said this X pulsar, you're putting in a different slope.
A harder spectrum,
and
correct.
And then the normalization, but these are also spinning down, right? And
mm-hmm.
seeing electrons from long ago, photons from more recently. So is these photon measurements going to pin down the normalization in the past?
Well, so I believe that if you know the period of the pulsar, you can work your way back, assuming some degree of efficiency in energy losses in radiating the relativistic particles. So that's sort of the way you reconstruct the power.
So what kind of uncertainty do you get if you work?
Again, I'm not an expert, but roughly speaking, I think, you know, it's within an order of magnitude or so. Maybe more.
I'm not sure that age is the right or only the right parameter. Because there's some pulsars that are really old. The pulsar magnetic fields are all over the place,
mm-hmm.
over a number of orders of magnitude. Those ages you get by the spin down rate. Right? But you can have two pulsars that have the same age, one of which is spinning much more rapidly than the other, and one which has a magnetic field that's much stronger than the other.
Yeah.
So I don't know that age is the right parameter.
Well, I believe you combine radio data in terms of the flux and the
rotation period, but I'm the wrong person to ask how accurately we can measure the total output of a supernova remnant. I mean, the thing that is interesting to me is that it's the right ballpark. I mean, you know,
even if you don't have the flux normalized occurrence rates or winds with an explanation.
It's reasonable.
Yeah, it's already there.
Yeah.
I asked my question about sort of the impact of GLAST or upcoming photon experiment. You didn't really. What about Pamela? I mean, there, if I want to use this explanation for Pamela, is GLAST going to make a strong statement?
Well, you know, I think GLAST has the potential to make a strong statement, but as Hooper et al.
Do they have the sensitivity to potentially?
Certainly for nearby objects, yes. But, you know, if you look back at the Hooper et al. Result, here, this is a coherence proposition of all supernova remnant in the galaxy. So in that case, you know, you have a bunch of sources which are relatively faint, and you know, your normalization basically depends on the rate at which these supernova go off.
Okay, but I know you can fit the Pamela data with this. I'm just asking, what about GLAST? Is GLAST going to... You're saying GLAST can't... GLAST can or can't tell whether this sort of a solution...
So what I'm trying to say is that if we are in a situation like this, where most of the signal comes from a coherent superposition of relatively faint supernova remnant, that GLAST would have less to say than in a scenario like this, where you have a very bright and very hard single nearby source.
Right.
So I guess a related question though is so what you're saying, we're seeing the gammas now, but the positrons come before, so in order to constrain these things like age, distance, do you need to observe the remnant itself in deep X-ray observations, and can that give you the constraints that you need?
Yeah, so X-ray... Yeah, this is a very good question. You know, the more multi-wavelength data you have, the better you do in terms of fitting various parameters. Here, for instance, you know, you have two directions for the magnetic field because you have an axial symmetry. So you have these two directions, and you have two values of the magnetic field. You have an escape time for the electrons. You have a slope for the electrons. So, you know, when you start going into the detail, then you really can do much better if you have a handle on several different frequencies to constrain all of these parameters. So, you know, if you take a very simple model and you just normalize with a simple inverse Compton type emission to gamma rays, that's one thing. But, you know, the more multi-wavelength data you have, the better you understand the object and its, you know, fine details. Well, you know, you sort of can see it here. Now, these are ROSAT data, and you see that, for instance, the cutoff energy of the spectrum of V plus E minus is fairly strongly constrained by synchrotron emission at the X-ray frequencies. So, you know, yes. The short answer is yes.
For the present, message I'm getting is that for ADIC, there are some very high energy sources do the trick, and we won't know, at least in the near future, we won't be able to check that. And for Pamela, there's this diffuse thing, lower energy sources are enough, that's reasonable, and
yeah.
Then again, at least in the foreseeable future, we won't know.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's going to be very exciting to see what GLAST will tell us, because, for instance, if the bump is there, then GLAST certainly will give a lot of details on the E plus and minus spectrum. So, you know, if this two bump structure is real or not, probably GLAST will be able to tell us. So that's a significant amount of information.
I don't know if you've successfully reduced the number of dark matter papers about.
Yeah, you know. You know, I was planning to put a slide comparing the, you know, ratio of ordinary matter to baryonic matter and the ratio of papers that explain positron data in terms of, and it's roughly comparable, actually.
Seems like
Yeah. So I think it would be really interesting to put these sources in, for instance, in Galprop and see what it, you know, dumps off in X-ray or gamma rays. Because yes.
So Galprop just has a uniform injection, spatially uniform injection. It doesn't have point sources.
You have the freedom to put point sources in Galprop.
No, but you would have to put each of these supernova in one by one. Galprop doesn't know about that ANT.
I think it makes something like we saw Hooper et al. Doing. So it's an average sort of, you know, superposition of all of the supernova remnant. But I, you know, I'm not entirely sure whether they, but I don't think so. They didn't built in, you know, pulsars out of catalogs. It would be fairly tricky because you have a lot of leeway for each individual source. So.
Kenyakowski's scheduled for a half an hour, and coffee will come at some point. So it's supposed to come now. I think it's 4:30. So coffee is on the way. Okay. You want to go ahead? Just go ahead. You want to do the Blackboard talk?
Okay.